Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On August 1st, 2022, President Joe Biden announced that a U.S. drone strike had killed al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in Kabul, Afghanistan. 11 years earlier, President Barack Obama announced on May 2, 2011, that the U.S. had killed then al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The two most important men behind the September 11, 2001 attack on the United States, gone. As Biden said last month,
"Now, justice has been delivered, and this terrorist leader is no more."
But what of the terrorist organization they created? What of al-Qaeda? Has it, too, been neutralized as a threat against the United States? After more than 20 years in America's longest and most expensive multi-trillion dollar war in Afghanistan, after the creation of an even more massive and permanent national security state here in the United States, is the al-Qaeda threat a thing of the past? Well, Nelly Lahoud is an associate professor of security studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College. And she's author of the book, The Bin Laden Papers, How the Abbottabad Raid Revealed the Truth About al-Qaeda, Its Leader, and His Family. And Nelly joins us today. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for hosting me, Meghna.
And by the way, I should note that while you're a professor at the Army War College, you're here speaking on your own behalf and not on the behalf of the War College or the United States military. Well, so first and foremost, Nelly, what are the Bin Laden Papers?
Well, the Bin Laden Papers were the materials that were covered during the raid that killed Bin Laden. And there is a rich story behind these papers because the raid was supposed to be completed within 30 minutes. And the reason for this is because Admiral McRaven, who oversaw the raid, had concluded, had conducted a study back in 1996 that explored several historical missions and had concluded that such daring missions should be completed within 30 minutes, and any delay beyond 30 minutes equates with vulnerability.
Okay.
So this was part of the SEALs training, indeed.
Indeed. So, and I'm sorry, I'm just to jump in, and I forgive me, Nelly, but to give a little context for people who don't remember, this was that May 2nd, 2011, SEAL Team 6 raid in Abbottabad, Pakistan.
Correct.
Where the SEALs flew in. Into that compound there, accidentally left some U.S. Military equipment behind, but that's not the focus for today, and killed Osama bin Laden. It was all supposed to be done within 30 minutes, as you said. So what then happened that led them to be there a little bit longer?
So as the mission was underway, and though the SEALs killed bin Laden before the 30 minutes were up, they still asked for additional time on the ground. And the reason for this was because they found some computers and electronic gear on the second floor. So immediately, Admiral McRaven realized the potential invaluable intelligence that these materials would yield, and he granted them permission to stay some additional time. I reached out to him to inquire about this additional time, and he kindly let me know that about 40 minutes or so, he told them to wrap it up, and some 8 minutes later also they took off. So thanks to these additional 18 minutes, we now have access to al-Qaeda's closely guarded secrets.
So these, essentially those extra 18 minutes where the SEALs gathered all the equipment they found on the second floor, these were computers and hard drives that were Osama bin Laden's?
Indeed. Now, just to be clear, they've been declassifying them since 2012. Mm. And the biggest declassification occurred in November 2017 when the CIA declassified according to their public statement, everything that they're going to declassify. And so we have this massive volume of materials. We're talking, you know, thousands and thousands of them, including audio, video, and text files. I must have clicked on thousands of files before I determined that the text files were going to be the most important. And with the help of two research assistants, we went through some 97,000 files to determine which was internal communications. Now, most of them turned out to be materials such as newspaper articles, books, and so on. But included in these 97,000 files were about 6,000 Arabic pages of Al-Qaeda's internal communications. And that's it's only after we identified these that I was able to start working on the book.
So you read all 6,000 pages in the original Arabic?
Indeed, indeed.
So what impression, what first impression did you get of Osama bin Laden upon reading those pages?
Well, when you work with letters, you find yourself having to inhabit the world of the people whose letters you are reading. So the letters were brimming with revelations. When I first started working on the project, I assumed that I was going to, you know, enhance my understanding of Al-Qaeda. What I didn't expect is that they would transform the narrative about Al-Qaeda. Perhaps one of the most surprising element, and as many of the listeners would remember, that for a long time after 9/11, Al-Qaeda dominated the news, and many of the terrorist attacks around the world were attributed to Al-Qaeda. Mm. Now we discover in the letters that Al-Qaeda was effectively shattered in December 2001 following the fall of the Taliban. And bin Laden at the time, probably around November 2001, the letters indicate that he had to disappear out of the scene. And he didn't communicate with associates for almost 3 years. And the reason we know this is because in 2004, and that's when he resumed communications with his associates, we find the letters of his associates briefing him about the past 3 years after his disappearance. So clearly they were not in communications during this time, even though bin Laden was able to release public statements, but he was virtually incommunicado with his own associates. Mm. And we find out from these letters that Al-Qaeda was indeed shattered.
So when you say shattered, though, what do you mean? Because obviously bin Laden had to go into hiding because he was the most wanted man practically on planet Earth. He had the entire arsenal of the United States intelligence and military capacity pointed at him. So what then led you to, what in the papers makes you think that the organization, the man might have been in hiding, but what led you to think that the organization was shattered?
You're absolutely right, because when he did resume contact with them, he was full of ambitious plans. He wanted really to replicate 9/11, and if that proved difficult, he wanted his associates to be able to carry out some attacks on rail lines in the United States. And their responses, this is where we find out from their own responses about briefing him about what happened during the past 3 years, we find them describing their harrowing ordeals. They themselves write about the fact that Al-Qaeda was shattered. This is their own words. Mm. They brief him about the fact that many of the brothers were either captured, brothers, quote unquote, were either killed or captured. And by the time when he connected, there was only, of the top leaders of Al-Qaeda, there was only bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was killed last month, who remained as the top senior leaders. Everybody else were actually mid-level, second-tier leaders. And those letters make it clear to bin Laden that they were in no position to carry out the ambitious plans that he had. And they went on to actually tell him that we're no longer feeling secure in our own environment. They were concerned about being betrayed by the Taliban and the Afghan. And the advice that they had for him is that, you know, and to use their own words, when God knew of our afflictions, he opened the door of jihad for us in Iraq. So we should all head to Iraq because we're no longer safe out here.
Okay.
So they couldn't be any clearer.
Well, so what, and, can I just ask for, what did the papers reveal about, the correspondence reveal about bin Laden's own view, his own mindset about what the purpose of Al-Qaeda was in, you know, 2003, 2004 and onward? Because, of course, originally his intent was, you know, to establish this caliphate, but more importantly, to get the United States out of the Middle East, specifically right out of Saudi Arabia. But of course, attacking the U.S. on 9/11 produced the exact opposite effect, a profound increase in U.S. presence and military action in, you know, the very region of the Middle East and Central Asia. So did he continue to believe that his original goal to get the United States out of the Middle East was achievable?
You are actually absolutely correct, because that is precisely what he wanted to achieve out of the 9/11 attacks. Now, when he found out that his associates were feeling so insecure, and when he learned about the situation, his first command to his associates in 2004 was to hide. He really wanted them to make sure that they will no longer be meeting with people out in the open, and that they would only communicate through letters, through close circles of couriers. And his idea about hiding was that they would need to hide until they were in a position to resume the work, as he would call it, by which he meant international terrorism. He clearly wanted to be able to regain Al-Qaeda's ability to launch international terrorism. And that he never was able to achieve, though, to be clear, he never lost hope about that. And he continued to plan operations until the very end, up until 2010.
Well, Nelly Lahoud, stand by for just a moment. We'll talk more about what Nelly has read in those 6,000 pages of correspondence that Navy SEALs pulled out of Abbottabad, Pakistan, when they killed Osama bin Laden back in 2011. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're joined by Nelly Lahoud. She's an associate professor of security studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College. And she's author of the book, The Bin Laden Papers, How the Abbottabad Raid Revealed the Truth About Al-Qaeda, Its Leader, and His Family. And Nelly, so I just want to pick up with where we left off before the break here, because I'm curious about something. What do you think the papers reveal about Osama bin Laden's grasp of geopolitics? Because if he continued to believe that attacks on the United States would ultimately lead to a U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East and Central Asia, when in fact the exact opposite would happen, what does that lead you to believe about how much he understood how Washington works, how regional alliances between the United States and Saudi Arabia work?
This is actually one of the most surprising things for me out of the papers, because it is remarkable how little he understood about international relations and how little he understood about the limits of terrorism. He continued to believe right until the end that if he could hurt Americans more, he would be able to replicate what happened during the Vietnam War, that he would get the American people to take to the streets and to call on their governments to withdraw their military forces from Muslim-majority states. He firmly believed that if U.S. forces were to withdraw from Muslim-majority states, then the jihadis would be able to bring down the autocratic regimes if they were to fight them on a level playing field. This was his objective for 9/11, and he clearly failed at that. And this is the objective that he also had when he was planning attacks to sink oil tankers right at the end of his life towards 2010. And if I may, you know, in 2010, he came to realize, and that's what he wrote to his associates, that unless Al-Qaeda changed its strategy, and it was going to come to an end. He really wanted to achieve what he called a balance of terror with the United States, and he wanted to destroy 30% of the American economy. And he believed he could do that if he was able to sink many oil tankers that were exporting oil to the United States.
And oil tankers. So he thought that sinking oil tankers would lead to a 30% collapse of the United States economy. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, he did. I mean, partly there was some methodical planning, you know, in place in terms of how to go about sinking these oil tankers. And he had done his homework because there's a limited number of these vessels in the world, about 730 of them. Mm-hmm. And each one of them carries up to 2.2 million barrels of crude oil. And the idea was to carry out simultaneous attacks targeting these tankers along several shipping routes. Though the plan was highly detailed and methodical, it's clear at the same time that his own understanding of international relations, and as you said, how Washington works, was not well thought out. And again, he wanted to replicate the Vietnam anti-war protest to force the governments to withdraw from the Middle East. And we don't know. I mean, this was his plan at the time. And the reason why he couldn't proceed with that plan is because, firstly, we don't know whether they would be able to pull it off. And then the Arab Spring erupted, and then he was killed as well.
Right. Well, can I just jump in here for a second? Because this is really interesting to me, because a moment ago you were talking about how in the correspondence between bin Laden and his associates, the associates themselves are describing Al-Qaeda post-December of 2001 as shattered, right? And yet, though, in the subsequent years, especially in many of them during which bin Laden was in hiding, there was attack after attack after attack that was called Al-Qaeda linked, right? Bali in 2002, Istanbul in 2003, then attacks in Europe, Madrid, London, 2004 and 2005. I mean, these were terrible terrorist attack. Are you saying that, I mean, did bin Laden in the correspondence say that that Al-Qaeda was either linked or behind those attacks?
Let me be clear. The only attack that Al-Qaeda was able to carry out after 9/11 was the Mombasa attack in November 2002 that attacked an Israeli-owned Paradise Hotel and attempted to attack an Israeli jetliner, but missed. And the reason they were able to pull off this attack is because the operatives had been dispatched to East Africa before 9/11. All the other attacks, there's nothing in the letters that suggests that Al-Qaeda was behind these attacks, particularly because letters between 2004 up until 2011, they all continue to highlight Al-Qaeda's operational impotence. We find bin Laden itching for more international attacks and feeling really bothered because the those who were supposed to be mounting or planning international attacks, he deemed them to be incompetent. So throughout the years after 9/11, or the letters that we have, there is nothing in the letters to suggest that Al-Qaeda was behind 2004, 2005, any of the attacks that were mounted globally. In fact, we find them to be spectators. So, you know, this is not to say that there was no international terrorism, as you mm-hmm. highly pointed out, but Al-Qaeda itself was not able to carry out these mm-hmm. attacks.
Mm-hmm. So when would you say then that, from your analysis, Al-Qaeda as an organization capable of international terrorism, when was Al-Qaeda effectively defused or neutralized?
In December 2001, except for that 2002 attack, because it was, you know, the work was already in place. In December 2001, this is when really Al-Qaeda's ability to launch international terrorism came to a halt. And we find that they had to, for several reasons. In December 2001, Mullah Omar at the time ordered the Arabs to withdraw out of Afghanistan. Mullah Omar himself came under a lot of pressure. He had been a supporter of Al-Qaeda, and he came under pressure from the various Afghan tribes because they believed that the air campaign was targeting Arabs and their families. So Al-Qaeda found itself in this unenviable position of having to evacuate Afghanistan to comply with Mullah Omar's order. And initially, some of them headed toward Pakistan. And there, they were met by a comprehensive campaign of arrest. And the letters describe that about 600, quote-unquote, brothers were captured and many were killed. So the remaining Al-Qaeda leaders, including some of bin Laden's family, had to cross illegally into Iran, where, you know, they were able to be supported by the Baluch brothers. That's what the letters refer to them. And these were Sunni militants who were opposed to the Iranian regime. Initially, they were able to help them find houses and stay under the radar. But within less than a year, the Iranian government was able to track them down and detain them. So Al-Qaeda's senior leaders, including bin Laden's family, they were detained in Iran. And those who fled to Pakistan, they were also either killed or detained. And this is not really where it ended. Mm. In 2004, when bin Laden decided that he was going to rebuild his organization by initially asking his associates to hide and so on, we find that the drone campaign began to have its effect, the CIA drone campaign. And by 2007, 2008, we find the effectiveness of the drone campaign being really palpable throughout the letters. Letters reaching bin Laden were reporting the quote-unquote the martyrdom of brothers. We find them being unable to hide and to be disciplined in the manner that bin Laden and Al-Qaeda's security community had urged them to do. So they weren't being disciplined enough to maintain all the security measures that they needed to maintain in order to evade the drones. So we find many of them were being killed and hunted down by the drones highly effectively.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking today with Nelly Lahoud. She's author of the book, The Bin Laden Papers, How the Abbottabad Raid Revealed the Truth About Al-Qaeda, Its Leader, and His Family. And it includes Nelly's analysis of thousands of pages of correspondence, which she read in the original Arabic that came from Osama bin Laden's hard drives that were recovered during the raid where Navy SEALs killed bin Laden back in 2011. Now, you know, Nellie, I hear what you're saying about the evidence that's contained in those correspondence about what those senior al-Qaeda leaders were thinking about their own capacity to effectively perform one of the massive attacks on a tower, on towers or on tankers. But it does make me wonder, though, if we're conceiving of al-Qaeda too narrowly. Because even back, in 2002, 2003, there was already analysis going on that al-Qaeda as a terrorist organization perhaps was less important than al-Qaeda as a movement, as a concept that inspired others to take up the jihadi mantle. So I want to put another perspective to you. It comes from Bill Roggio, a terrorism analyst and senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's also editor of the Long War Journal. And he told us that the loosely affiliated groups that we mentioned earlier, especially the regional groups, are in fact a source of power for al-Qaeda.
The problem that I see in the intelligence community and in the counterterrorism community's assessments of al-Qaeda's is that they'll dismiss al-Qaeda waging local insurgencies. But that is a complete misunderstanding of how al-Qaeda operates. Al-Qaeda uses local insurgencies in order to create a global caliphate. It wants to take countries over one at a time. And it siphons off fighters from these areas in order to launch what they call external attacks against the U.S. and against the West.
So Roggio essentially says that he does not believe al-Qaeda has been neutralized or defused. He's cautious about the idea that with the death of bin Laden and now Zawahiri, that the U.S. has, quote, decapitated al-Qaeda.
It's lost key leaders, but it's groomed its next level of leadership. Wouldn't expect, for instance, there is no... The president of the United States on 9/11 is no longer in government. Cabinet members in his government are no longer in government. Generals that served during 9/11 are no longer in the U.S. military. Al-Qaeda leaders don't retire. They don't take a board position. They don't run a foundation. They either die of old age or they die while waging jihad. And so, of course, they're prepared for their next level of leadership.
Roggio says one more thing. He warns that the new leaders of al-Qaeda, as he sees them, are playing a long game, even as Osama bin Laden arguably did in planning for 9/11, and that those new leaders, even if they aren't currently capable of launching a big attack right now...
Terrorism or conducting a 9/11 type attack or blowing up a movie theater or a concert, or that is merely a tactic of al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda uses that tactic in order to weaken the resolve of the West. Al-Qaeda launched 9/11, the 9/11 attack, because it believed that the U.S. was weak and that would force the U.S. to withdraw from the Middle East. I think Al-Qaeda miscalculated. The U.S. doubled down and has made significant mistakes, particularly the invasion of Iraq, in my opinion. But ultimately, Al-Qaeda thought that it could grind us down. And I think if we look at Afghanistan, you could see success, right?
That's Bill Roggio, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. So Nellie LaHood, respond to that. I mean, Bill Roggio essentially is making the argument that focusing on al-Qaeda leadership is missing the point, that the organization, even dispersed, continues to be a dangerous one.
So I'm not questioning the dangerous elements of jihadi groups that are carrying out international terrorism. Let me be clear about that. But I think nothing pleases al-Qaeda more than listening to Bill Roggio explaining how powerful they are and that somehow, as he put it, al-Qaeda uses, because that is far from al-Qaeda's reality. And the letters make it abundantly clear that al-Qaeda struggled to influence these regional jihadi groups acting in its name. By 2010, we find bin Laden writing in his own letters that these groups had become a liability to global jihad. And frankly, he had good reason to believe that this is the case, because the letters of these regional jihadi groups expose that beneath their vows of allegiance to Al-Qaeda or to bin Laden specifically, they had no desire to act in unison or to comply with bin Laden's advice or the advice of his associates. We find them struggling to have influence over these groups. The only group that seemed to be in sync with bin Laden's pragmatic and strategic views was the North African group, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. But we find the parent group of the Islamic State that was led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Initially, it proved to be a lifeline for Al-Qaeda, but soon after they merged with Al-Qaeda, we find that Zarqawi targeted his attacks against the Shia of Iraq, and clearly that's not what Al-Qaeda signed up for. They gave him the brand because they wanted Al-Qaeda to be in the news for killing Americans and not Iraqis.
Well, Nelly, I'm just going to take it from you there because I just have to take a very quick break. We'll pick up this this portion of the conversation in just a minute when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Nelly Lahoud joins us today. She's Associate Professor of Security Studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College and author of the Bin Laden Papers, How the Abbottabad Raid Revealed the Truth About Al-Qaeda, Its Leader, and His Family. And it's the result of Nelly's examination of more than 6,000 pages of Arabic language correspondence between Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders that were found on bin Laden's hard drive when SEAL Team 6 killed bin Laden in 2011. Now, Nelly, before the break, we were talking about these al-Qaeda affiliate groups and their importance in this picture. And I wanted to just shift the focus a little bit because, you know, we could plausibly make the argument that those affiliate groups were and are perhaps of less interest to the United States because maybe they cannot launch a major attack on U.S. soil. But that too makes me think that, again, we as you were saying earlier, we ought to have a broader perspective here because those affiliate groups, truly, the people they've most victimized are their fellow Muslims in the regions, particularly, you know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, for example.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, in one of his letters, bin Laden writes to his associates, he says, most Muslims are repulsed by these groups' attacks. So bin Laden was quite worried about global jihad being tarnished by these groups. So for somebody to say that somehow Al-Qaeda uses these groups when Al-Qaeda is complaining, when Al-Qaeda's leaders are complaining about these groups and about their indiscriminate attacks and their lack of ability to focus their global jihad on the United States, this worried Al-Qaeda a great deal. And that's why they became a liability as far as Al-Qaeda and bin Laden in particular. So it's one thing to speak about the threat that these groups pose. It's something completely different to say that Al-Qaeda has command and control over these groups, because this really misses the point of the reality of these groups and of the fact that the leaders of Al-Qaeda have been hiding since late 2001. And they're in no way, in no position to be able to make these big decisions and to influence those groups that are acting in their name. And that is the reality that is missed in the analysis of Wilbert Gier.
Well, let's talk specifically about Al-Qaeda's relationship with the Taliban, because of course that relationship was close and tight prior to 9/11, which is what ultimately led the United States then to spend the subsequent 20 years in Afghanistan. But what does the correspondence found on bin Laden's hard drive say about the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban after December 2001 and 2002 and beyond?
Actually, I was more than surprised by what I discovered in the letters about this relationship. What remained constant is Al-Qaeda's loyalty to Mullah Omar. That is very clear throughout the letters. But what became really evident in the letters is the Taliban's factionalism. And from Al-Qaeda's perspective, they categorized the Taliban as those who were sincere, meaning those who were obviously loyal to Al-Qaeda, and those who were insincere, and those who were lured by American dollars, and those who were ready to compromise God's law. And let me be specific here. As early as 2004, we find that Al-Qaeda's leaders stopped feeling secure in their own environment. In 2007, we find in the letters that the Taliban are seeking to dissociate themselves from Al-Qaeda because they wanted to avoid the label terrorist. And surprisingly, astonishingly, in fact, in 2010, we find both bin Laden and his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was killed last month, discussing the fact that the Taliban were ready to sell out Al-Qaeda, to enter into a peace deal with the United States that would render Al-Qaeda operationally impotent. We find bin Laden warning his associates that these are people who want to drag us with them in their path of error. You shouldn't share your secrets with them, and be careful that they will not hesitate to shed your blood. Ayman al-Zawahiri himself predicted that they're going to sell out Al-Qaeda. And what pleased him at the time, or what consoled him at the time, is that Mullah Omar was still alive and he wouldn't be dealing with the United States. Now, the people they designate in the letters as being, and to use Ayman al-Zawahiri's own words, hypocrites, traitors, those who compromise God's law, ended up being those Taliban leaders who went to Qatar and they entered into the peace process with the United States.
Yeah. So, but Minelli, if I may, in a sense, it's almost understandable that there would be this, paranoid fear amongst Al-Qaeda leaders themselves that the Taliban might sell them out. But outside of the correspondence, as you know, we also know what the Taliban told the United States in 2020, 2021, during the very negotiations over U.S. withdrawal. The Taliban refused to repudiate or expel Al-Qaeda in those U.S. negotiations. And then, of course, Zawahiri was killed in Kabul. He was in Afghanistan. So does that not suggest a closer or at least less at odds relationship today between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda?
Well, let's remember bin Laden was found hiding in Abbottabad. And we know from his letters that he took every measure to hide and to evade from, not just from the CIA, but also from the Pakistani authorities. Ayman al-Zawahiri was even more careful than bin Laden about his security measures. And what this tells me, the fact that he was killed in Kabul, tells me that those Taliban who were supportive of Al-Qaeda are fewer and fewer by the day. And let's remember one thing, that after the Taliban's return to power last year, Ayman al-Zawahiri released several public statements warning the Taliban that the fact that they were seeking recognition by the international community and seeking membership in the United Nations, that this they were risking being an apostasy of Islam, that they were going to compromise God's law. So imagine being the Taliban and listening to Ayman al-Zawahiri telling the world that they are an apostasy of Islam. From judging by the letters and how Ayman al-Zawahiri was speaking about those Taliban leaders, they couldn't be happier to see him gone. I have no doubt that the Taliban, those who are in power at the moment, I'm sure there are factions within the Taliban that continue to be loyal to Al-Qaeda and be supportive of Al-Qaeda. I have no doubt about that. And the letters make it clear. But those who are in power at the moment, those who return to power, they couldn't be happy listening to Ayman al-Zawahiri criticizing their political direction. So it doesn't surprise me at all that Ayman al-Zawahiri was killed. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Taliban are very happy. I mean, they certainly aren't mourning him at the moment.
Well, it still does puzzle me, though, then why a Taliban leadership, when at the negotiating table with the United States in that moment, would not publicly, or at least in those talks, repudiate Al-Qaeda. But on this note about sort of Al-Qaeda and Afghanistan right now, I just want to turn back to our conversation with Bill Roggio, because, again, he has quite a different view. He's the senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and editor of the Long War Journal. We heard from him a little bit earlier. His view is that Al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan is actually much bigger and has been established for longer than official estimates suggest.
Beginning in 2010, there was an official estimate given by the director of the CIA at the time that said there were only 50 to 100 Al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan. That number remained static for 6 years, and I would track U.S. military operations press releases announcing the killing of Al-Qaeda fighters. And every year, that number was anywhere from 25 to 100 killed. So you have to question that static number right there.
And it's not just the numbers that Roggio calls into question. He also calls into question the geography and the strength of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
The other claim was Al-Qaeda was confined to two provinces in the north, Gunar and Nuristan. Lo and behold, in October 2015, the U.S. launches a raid against Al-Qaeda training camp in southeastern Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda supposedly wasn't, and kills about 150 or more. It was two training camps. One of the camps was described as the largest camp the U.S. had seen since 9/11, and that's global.
Well, now that the Taliban is back in control in Afghanistan, as we've discussed, they've given assurances that they want to have nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, or have they? I mean, it is puzzling. Regardless, Bill Roggio finds no reason to believe the Taliban.
The Al-Qaeda-Taliban alliance is alive and well and as strong as it ever has been. The Taliban is giving Al-Qaeda safe haven right now, and Al-Qaeda leaders and military leaders and operatives and fighters have been present in Afghanistan all along. They played a key role in the Taliban takeover of the country, and there are some that are moving in the country today. And we killed Al-Qaeda's top leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's the most wanted man in the world, not in some cave along the borders of the Afghan-Pakistan border. They killed him in the heart of Kabul, and he was being sheltered by the Taliban's one of two deputy Taliban emirs who also serves as their interior minister.
And finally, Bill Roggio says that this is the thing that ultimately poses a threat to the United States.
If you give Al-Qaeda the time and space, it will work to innovate its next attack on us. And it has right now, it has both safe haven in Afghanistan as well as state sponsorship. The Taliban controls Afghanistan. It is sponsoring Al-Qaeda. It is giving Al-Qaeda shelter. And that makes Al-Qaeda extremely dangerous.
Once again, that's Bill Roggio from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Now, Nelly Lahoud, I want to put to you a question that Roggio essentially asked us, and that is, Washington wanted to get out of Afghanistan. The American people's appetite for for prolonging our two-decade war there had obviously gone away. But policy-wise and politically as well, it's hard to say it's time to get out of Afghanistan if Al-Qaeda, the reason why we were there to begin with, is still alive and well in Afghanistan. So he's essentially wondering if, the national security establishment is downplaying the threat of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan so as to have made way for the U.S. withdrawal from there. What do you think?
So let me be very clear. My book is not doing the bidding for the United States. In fact, the analysis that I do in the book, in fact, undermines quite a lot of the reporting that was done by intelligence agencies that were made publicly available about Al-Qaeda's capabilities post 9/11. So I'm not doing anybody's bidding, and I'm not doing anything for the government. I want to go back to the point about Zawahiri being sheltered by the Taliban. And about Al-Qaeda's capabilities. Now, we are talking, nothing that he said is reconcilable with Ayman al-Zawahiri's letters and the associates of Ayman al-Zawahiri. Throughout the letters, we find Zawahiri and his associates describing the Taliban as those who compromise God's religion. So he has a completely different view of what was happening. And to be very clear, bin Laden didn't know where Zawahiri was hiding. This is how stringent their security measures were. The reason why they took these stringent security measures is because they wanted to evade the authorities, including the Pakistani authorities, the Afghan authorities, and so on. So the fact that he was sheltered in Kabul, as it was reported, it wouldn't surprise me if he had been there all along. The fact that it was reported that he recently moved to Kabul surprises me a great deal, because of all people, Zawahiri would be so careful about his own movements. Well, so this idea of putting Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in bed together at the moment is irreconcilable with Zawahiri's own letters and with Al-Qaeda's own letters.
Mm. Point taken. I also wonder, though, if this could potentially be the enemy of my enemy is my friend moment here. But
precisely.
So we have just a minute left, and I'm sorry to have to close this conversation, Nelly, but one more question for you, because you're one of very few people who's read all of this correspondence in the original Arabic. I mean, do you think if we had known the contents of the papers earlier, before 2011, would that have changed any decisions the United States made in the course of, our decades-long war on terror?
This is a question that I think practitioners, particularly U.S. military leaders, are better placed than me to answer it. It is clear to me that Al-Qaeda's threat was highly exaggerated, and I suspect, as I said, they are better placed than me, but I suspect that had this information been known, there would have been different policies towards Al-Qaeda and international terrorism broadly.
Well, Nelly Lahoud, Associate Professor of Security Studies in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College. Her book is The Bin Laden Papers, How the Abbottabad Raid Revealed the Truth About Al-Qaeda, Its Leader, and His Family. Nelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.